Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 135, recorded October 15th, 2012.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers.
Hello. We are going to get into some of these more lengthy questions that we talked about last week that people had asked. So that's going to be most of what we talk about today, about photography and umbunas.
Not necessarily
photographing umbunas, but talking about photography and then talking about umbunas.
Yes.
Not that you couldn't photograph your umbunas.
And yeah, you definitely can. So first question was...
But first, before we get there.
Yes.
A few beta notes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they've been growing like crazy lately, haven't they?
Yes.
And really sprouting up.
Grown-up little fishies.
Yeah, they love that Edison's Beta Pro. Well, a major ingredient thereof is decapsulated brine shrimp cysts. So they're growing really fast on that. It's easier to feed them that now, and they seem to be really, really thriving on it. So
they still crush up the pellets. They're still too small to eat a whole pellet.
Right, they're still too small to eat a whole pellet, but they're almost there. We're still crushing them up. They're just going to town. It's amazing to watch them grow, and a lot of the males now... not just acting like males, but looking like males. They have bigger finnages than the females and so on, so it's been fun to see. They look like miniature placuts right now because their finnage is not completely developed yet. And the comb tail trait, so the intermediate between crown tail and normal tail, is actually turning out to look really nice because none of them have really extended rays, but they have just little fringes on their fins that look really nice.
It looks nice. I like the comb tail better than the straight crown tail.
Mm-hmm. And then some of them seem to have double tail genes, because I've heard that double tails are used to improve half moon lines. And I was looking at that, and especially with regard to the dorsal fin, because basically a double tail's dorsal fin is like a mirror image of its anal fin, has many more rays. So it has a very broad base, like a anal fin of the beta. And we have a few in there that have stockier bodies, which is typical of double tails, and a much wider base on the dorsal fin. So that's been interesting to see. Just a few of them are like that. But it's fun. Okay. Oh, and next, both Tony in New York and Mick in Carnforth, UK, sent in some great Halloween fish species for Halloween. So
yes,
we'll be talking more about that as our Halloween episode, which is, let's see, in 2 weeks from now, I guess, is when we're going to do it.
I'm excited for that. We were actually, before we started, we were just talking about a little flourish we might give it.
Yeah, so, well, we won't reveal that yet, but you'll see how that goes. But the fish species, if you have other creepy or bizarre or otherwise suitable species for a Halloween show, you're welcome to send those in as well. We're looking forward to that.
Okay. So we are going to get started talking about photographing your fish. And who was it that asked about it now?
It was Tony in New York.
Oh, it was Tony. Okay. So he wanted to know your tips.
Okay.
So the first one that Russ is going to talk about is angle.
Well, before that, I'm just going to give my usual disclaimer that I'm not an expert on taking pictures of fish. But, okay, that said...
You have a lot of practice.
Okay, that said... angle is very important, of course, and many of you know this if you've ever tried to take a picture of a fish, especially with a flash, that if you try to take a picture of a fish head-on, you're going to get a big, glary patch of bright light in the middle of your picture. And the best way to usually avoid doing this is to take it from an angle, either from maybe 45 degrees above, you know, where you want to take the picture, or below, or even to the side, or, you know, experiment with that. I often take the picture from below or above. That helps a lot in eliminating the glare that you'd otherwise get from the flash. And that might seem like an elementary thing, but and for Tony, for example, I'm sure he's aware of that, but there may be other novice aquarists or experienced aquarists who are novice photographers with regard to fish that could benefit from that. I hope so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the next point you wanted to talk about was a few other tips to reduce glare.
Yeah, well, when you're taking videos or stills, you've probably seen, for example, YouTube videos where you'll see someone's aquarium and then you'll see the rest of their house basically reflected in it. One way to reduce that, which, you know, is not necessarily a bad thing, but if you don't want people to see your living room, you just want them to focus on your tank.
You don't want people to see your underwear strewn all over, you know, the bathroom counter in the background or...
whatever it happens to be. Yeah. Then...
pile full of dirty dishes.
Yeah, whatever it is. You don't want people to see that, so you can just darken the rest of the room and depend on the aquarium lighting and or the lighting of your camera to, you know, light up the aquarium. A lot of digital cameras do really well if you just have the aquarium light on and you don't use a flash at all. There'll be enough light, in many cases, especially with video, to get some good shots. With stills, not quite as much, but it depends. If you have a really well-illuminated aquarium, you still might be fine.
So if you have a window across the room from the aquarium, you know, close the drapes, there's a lamp, turn the lamp off so you don't have a picture of the lamp in your glass.
Exactly.
Okay, point number three is stability.
Yeah. Well, common sense maybe, but use a tripod. But Kelly has a good point relating to that.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, it doesn't have to be an expensive, fancy, from a professional photographer shop tripod. If you live in the U.S., they have various dollar stores. There's like Dollar Tree and there's All Dollar, that kind of thing. Everything's a dollar, and they often will have little mini tripods that, you know, it doesn't stand 4 feet up, but if you have a counter or something near your tank that you're taking pictures of, you can just use the little mini tripod, and it's only a dollar.
Right.
So we've got one of those. They're useful.
Yeah, and even the other ones, you can get a basic tripod for $20, $25.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be.
Here. Yeah, but if you don't have a tripod, you can often use the glass to stabilize your camera. If you're taking some close-up shots, I'll often lean the housing of the lens, and I don't have a fancy camera. It's not like a single-lens reflex or anything. It's just
just a camera.
It's a point-and-shoot. It's a higher-end point-and-shoot, but it is one. It has a zoom lens, but I'll carefully lean that up against the glass, and that will help stabilize it with my hands, maybe my elbows against something, and I'll stabilize it, so that can help make sure you get a good, or at least a better shot.
Okay, let's talk about videos versus still pictures.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you first of all that video is usually easier to get in terms of better shots. You'll just get better shots in general. And with a lot of video editing software, you can clip a frame from a video and use it as a still. Mm-hmm. It may not be, you know, the best quality one, but it's often pretty decent these days. You get a decent clip from that. To get a still, and in general, videos perform better than stills do in lower light. You can usually get a much better, clearer video than you could get a still in, when you're taking a shot in pretty low light. And then when you are doing stills, for every good shot you take, you're going to take at least 20, maybe 50 really crummy shots that you wish you didn't have, and you just have to delete
them. That's why we're glad it's not a film camera, right?
Right.
Just delete them.
Right. And so every single shot that I put up ever, I've taken at least 10, 15, 20 or more shots trying to get that shot that didn't come out at all. So it's something just not to be discouraged with and just plan on. Mm-hmm. I'm going to shoot a whole bunch of crummy shots now, and maybe I'll get one or two that are going to work. And sometimes with cameras, the more advanced your cameras get, you can start experimenting with aperture and shutter speed and so on. Sometimes you can get some really nice shots that way. I've done that with our goldfish. Mm-hmm. I've taken some shots when I'm playing around with that, and honestly, I can't recall exactly which ones or what settings I used, but just you can experiment with that if your camera will allow you to do that. And I did get some pretty nice action shots. You can also just use the action shot setting on some cameras. They have an easy action shot setting that will help with fish since they're always moving around. So it's worth trying.
Okay, let's talk about the idea of creating a good shot.
Oh, okay. Well, this is what I like to do to help create a good shot. I like to invite the fish to sit where I can focus on them. And I've talked a little bit about this before, but basically you find out where is going to be a good place for you to focus, and then you make sure your fish are there by feeding them in that spot.
Mm-hmm.
And it works out. It's good for video. It's good for stills, too. But just... you know, it can be as simple as dropping an algae chip in exactly the spot you want them to be hanging out, or it, you know, putting brine shrimp, targeting brine shrimp into a specific spot with an eyedropper, like I did in some of the videos that I used to showcase our baby bettas.
And that makes sense, because if the fish that you want to take a picture of is hiding in the plants, you're not going to get a very good shot.
Exactly. So, there you go. That's short and sweet.
Okay, any last tips?
Yeah. One, and this sounds kind of maybe really basic, but
well, make basic sure things matter. Little things make a difference.
They do. Just make sure you thoroughly clean the glass on the inside to get rid of algae and things like that, but also on the outside. And I would say, before you do any shooting, clean it well. It makes a big difference. For some reason, dust that you don't notice when you're looking into your aquarium really shows up on camera. And ideally, you do it an hour or so before you shoot, so that any little particulates that you release by, you know, bits of algae or whatever that you might knock loose from the glass are not kicked up and dancing around in the water column, because the filters had time to pick them up.
Right.
And that will make a huge difference in getting a really clean shot. Even algae you don't really see in the glass, when you're looking into the aquarium, the camera will pick it up in some way, whether it makes it difficult for the focus or
sharp.
It looks cloudy, yeah. Whatever. And the same with dust on the outside or hard water or stains or whatever. So,
okay.
Those would be my tips. There are some many more experienced aquarium photographers out there. So if any of you have some tips you'd like to share with us, then please send them in.
And let's go ahead and take our break, and then we'll do Mbunas.
Okay, and thanks, Tony, for the question. Hopefully that helped.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nell.
Okay, we're going to talk about Mbunas.
Yeah, it was Tyson. In Australia.
Yes, he wanted us to just kind of focus on them a little bit.
Yeah, he's got some. And so he wanted us to talk about them a little bit. So,
why don't you give us a little intro?
Okay. Well, for those of you who may not know a whole lot about Mbunas, these are cichlids. They're African cichlids from Malawi, Lake Malawi. And they are specifically cichlids that live in part of the lake where they're in a rocky area, down near the bottom, where they defend a territory in a rocky area. There are other fish in the lake that, you know, are open water swimmers and things like that, and those are not referred to as Mbuna. I believe Utaka is the term that they use for that. And Mbuna, I believe, means something like rock fish.
Because they live in the rocks.
Yes. And they're brightly colored in general. They're quite aggressive. As I mentioned, they're territorial, and
people often think they're saltwater fish when they come into your house.
Yeah.
Because they're so bright.
Yeah. We would have people say, oh, look at that saltwater tank you've got. That's pretty cool. And we'd say, oh, that's not saltwater.
It's freshwater, yeah.
And I'm sure other people have had that same experience. And they tend to eat, in the wild, they eat something called aufuchs, which I think we mentioned that before. It's basically algae and whatever little crustaceans and so on dwell in that algae. So they kind of scrape it off their rocks. And
algae salad.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why they protect their territory, partly for that reason, because the algae and the aufuchs grow on the rocks, and so they protect it so that they can have food, because food is one of the limiting factors in the lake there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay, what kind of water parameters do people need if they're going to keep Mbunas?
Well, they need fairly hard alkaline water. That's what they have in the wild. And luckily, for many of us, that's what we get out of the tap. Of course, if you don't get out of that tap, you're going to need to modify it somewhat. But it's always easier to add things to your water than it is to take them out. So, a couple of things you can do to make sure they have fairly hard alkaline water is use a buffering substrate. There are commercial substrates that are made specifically to buffer the water for Mbunas. you can use those. Some people can use, they've used marine substrates like crushed coral and things like that. You can get rock work, like Texas Holy Rock, which helps buffer the water and add some of the ions you need to keep it hard and alkaline. And there are other things you can do. You can add Rift Lake salts, the salts that are specifically balanced with things like calcium, magnesium, and the right proportions, and iron, and so on, so that you get a water that's very similar to what they get in their natural lake situation. They do need that to thrive. They don't thrive in, you know, neutral tap water really all that well.
Okay. Let's talk about water changes, what kind of filtration they need. So tell us what they need in regards to those things.
Okay, things like the setup, basically, that they need.
The setup,
yeah.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I would say you need to get a large tank, because they are fairly aggressive, and we'll talk more about that later, but you can't keep Mbunas very successfully in a small tank if you have a number of them. There are probably exceptions out there. Some are less aggressive than others. Some people may manage to do it, but you need a pretty big tank. When we did it, and this was, you know, a number of years ago, but we had a 55-gallon tank, and I would say that was too small. We had too many issues with aggression in that tank. Not that we didn't get it to work in general. It did work in general, but it wasn't ideal, and we were having aggression problems. Now, so I would say try something bigger than a 55 if you can. Keep the heat in mid to high 70s. Around 78 is good for Fahrenheit. You know, you can convert that to Celsius if you need to. Interestingly enough, a lot of lighting, really high lighting, is really not the greatest thing for them. A lot of times they seem to wash out, at least in my experience and the experience of others.
Bottom of the lake usually?
Maybe.
Not quite right exactly in the sun?
Yes, you don't really need some really super intense light to display them to advantage. And you do want to get some algae growth in there, but you don't need super intense lighting for that. So, you know, moderate lighting is okay. Even fairly low lighting is okay. And their colors are so bright that they really, you know, they show up anyway. You can still see them. There are relatively few plants that will thrive in an Mbuna tank because they eat them. So if you want to get rid of some plants that are growing
toss
in another tank,
in
you can toss them there and they'll eat them. I did that. I would throw in some, you know, we had some guppy grass growing in a couple other tanks, and I would just toss in guppy grass and they'd munch it down, things like that. So there are a few plants that can do okay, and it depends on the species of Mbuna, because some are less destructive to plants than others. But, you know, you might want to try maybe Java fern, Anubias, some of the vals, Vallis nereus can work, but in general, plants will not do very well because they'll get chomped. And then, of course, you need a lot of rock work.
What kind of rocks?
Well, you need some place for the fish to hide, some place for them to call their own, to have a territory, to have a hole they can retreat to.
A little cave they can call home.
Right. So you can use real rocks. I did. I used lace rock. That's what it's called here, and probably in other locations too. A fairly light rock, but it's inert, the one I used. Fairly inert. Doesn't, you know, add carbonates or whatever to the water. But you can stack it. It's got a lot of holes and crevices in it. It's very bumpy and has big flat sections. So I built caves with it and stacked them up. You have to be really careful stacking up the caves.
So they don't fall and crack your tank.
Right. They can fall and crack the tank. They can fall and kill fish.
Now, didn't you glue them together in the arrangement that you wanted?
I did experiment with that, with using epoxy to stick some of the rocks together. And I did that with some of them, but not all of them.
So some were balanced and some were glued.
Some were balanced and some were glued, but let me just say, it's at your own risk, the stacking the rocks. You've got to be really careful with that, making sure that they're extremely stable, and it takes some practice. One good thing that I would do is stack the rocks every time I'd redo it, because I would redo it once in a while. Stack the rocks outside the tank, see if it were an aesthetically pleasing arrangement of rocks, and
then practice putting
them together too, and then say, okay, is this going to work? What do you think? And Kelly would look at it and say, yeah, this is working, or here, move this over here, whatever. Do that for a while and then put them back in extremely carefully. And, wow, it was quite an undertaking.
In fact, you would often take a picture of how you had figured out that you wanted them to be,
mm-hmm.
so that you could refer to the picture when you were moving them back into the tank.
Right, or a sketch.
Or sometimes. Something like that, so you could remember, oh yeah, I had this one over here.
Right. And so just be careful with that. There are also some other things you can look at, different kinds of rocks. I use lace rock, but there's Texas holy rock, there's tufa stone there. You can use terracotta pots as far as that goes. They're lighter than most rock, and fish like to hide in them. Of course, they don't look as natural, but if you don't care about that, then that's okay. There are also, somewhere middle ground, you can get ceramic rocks that are hollow. They're, of course, artificial rocks, but made of ceramic. Hollow so that you can stack them, but they have a little hole in them, and they work very well. Cichlid stones is at least one. I know that there's a brand, Cichlid stones, that does that, and they can work very well, and they're much lighter and less likely to damage the tank if they fall and so on. So that's one idea. And some people even use PVC pipe.
Now that, if you wanted to do like a funky decorative tank, you could set that up so that they look, you set it all up like apartment blocks or something, and put little lines in there with fishy laundry hanging out or something.
You could do something pretty funky that way.
That would be a funny little setup.
Yeah, so there are a lot of options there. There are even people who make their own rock, so to speak, out of polystyrene foam that they cover with cement paint, mm-hmm. basically. And that can look really nice. You can cut it however you want it, whatever shape you want it, and then you paint over it, you know.
How heavy is it with the cement paint on there?
No, it's not very, no, because rocks, it's right? got all that styrofoam there right. is where most of the bulk is, so it's much lighter. And probably less expensive too, and safer. It's, you know, it's not as heavy. And you can look that up on YouTube. It's very cool. And there are even people who do things with pond ceiling foam.
Hmm.
You can, that expanding pond ceiling foam, you can spray it on, and then you can cut it, come back and cut it later, and cover it over with different things. And so there
are. Same idea, just.
Yeah. A lot of options there.
Okay. Okay, what do they like to eat? You mentioned the Aufwuchs.
Aufwuchs, yeah.
Aufwuchs.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing that perfectly, but
probably you're not going to have a whole lot of that in your house.
Well, so. To some extent, you can get some of the algae to grow, and maybe if you have amphipods and copepods, you know, in the algae a little bit,
mm-hmm.
to some extent, you can reproduce that, and I have to some extent. It's not exactly the same, of course. Probably not as nutritive as what they'd get in the wild, but you do want to encourage some algae growth on the rocks and let them chew it off, and they will. But in tanks, their main food, you make sure they get pellets and flake and so on, and they do really well on that. Make sure you get a food that has high color-enhancing substances, natural color enhancers like carotenoids and astaxanthins and that kind of thing. They do need that if they're good to maintain their colors. And be careful with live foods. Some live foods are okay, but a lot of people like to avoid worms because they just don't seem to handle them digestively very well, and they can get Malawi bloat.
That doesn't sound very pleasant.
It is not, and it can be deadly. And so,
like colic or something?
Well, it's apparently some bacterial thing, and they bloat up, and they don't do well, and a lot of times they die. So it's, something that most people avoid. Don't give them worms, but they really don't need live food, like some fish do, to get them to spawn, mm-hmm. to get them to really thrive. They don't. I mean, they're getting the algae. They're getting live algae, and that's enough, okay. generally.
Now, most Mbunas are on the aggressive side.
Indeed they are.
So talk to us about dealing with that.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. You generally keep a fairly large group of them together to diffuse aggression. If you keep two Mbunas together, doesn't matter if they're male and female, two males, whatever, they're probably going to kill each other, you know, in most cases. Just speaking in general about all the, you know, species of Mbunas.
So if you have more of them together, is it just kind of too overwhelming? They just think, oh, there's just too many people to beat up, I'm not going to bother.
Right, so people will overcrowd them with that in mind. I've seen people keep a tank, like a 37-gallon tank,
mm-hmm.
with, you know, 30 Mbunas in it.
Oh my goodness.
And I think that's too many in a tank that big. And you'd really have to crazy overfilter it and do the water changes, you know, a lot to do it. But people do that. There are people who do that. But you do need to keep a fairly large number of them. If you're breeding and you just are interested in one species and you're breeding, you can get like a male and maybe three females in a tank. And then you wouldn't have to have such a huge tank. You could probably be okay with a 55 tank with one male and three females. Because then one female doesn't get the brunt of the aggression.
Right.
But if you want to keep a number of them together, it's good to get, maybe three or four species in a tank. And you have one male to two female ratio, or one male to even more females ratio in that tank of each species. And then they tend to do better. So, in our 55-gallon tank, we had, I don't remember, it's been a long time. But we made sure that we had a number of different species and that there were males and females of lots of different species. It worked out okay most of the time. But as I said, the aggression was a little too much in that 55, so I really would have had preferred to do it in a larger tank, maybe a 70, 80-gallon tank or something like that. If you want to keep one mbuna, you can do that.
Do they care? Do they get lonely?
They seem to do fairly well. I mean, you're not going to get the same sort of behavioral interaction that makes part of what makes it interesting.
They're so interesting to watch.
Right. But some people keep them as a specimen fish. You know, keep one of them in a 20-gallon tank. You could do that. But, you wouldn't want to put another one in there, that's for sure. So a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll go pick up six babies of one species and six babies of another species, and you put four or five species in the tank, six of them at once. And they'll try to put them all in the tank at about the same time.
So that they all are starting their territories right then, and nobody's already said, no, that's mine, you can't have it.
Right, because if you do put other fish in later on, you're going to have to do some rearranging of the rock work and so on. If you don't, they'll likely say, because this is my territory, I kill you.
Yeah.
And then they do. So, okay. And the other fish doesn't have the benefit of knowing where the hidey holes are. And so the new fish typically
the new kid gets
suffers.
Pummeled.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah. If you put six in one species at once and let them kind of grow up together and you do that with several species at the same time, you're more likely to have some success.
Okay, along those same lines of aggression, are there tank mates that you can keep with umbunus? And if so, what are they?
There are. There are some of the catfish, like the Cynodontis catfish. They tend to do well. Several species of those will do okay.
Why is that? Just they're not in the same niche? They're not competing for the same territory?
Well, some of those are actually... there are quite a few catfish in the lake, in Lake Malawi, that coexist with mbunas, and it's kind of a similar thing. So they're able to hold their own. Some of them actually specialize in eating baby mbunas and different things.
Oh, wow.
So, they tend to do okay. Many of the plecos are okay because of all the armor and spikes they have. They can protect themselves. Put a bristlenose or something in there, a pleco like that usually does okay. But then, of course, it's eating a lot of the algae that the mbunas could otherwise eat. Some people actually keep other cichlids with them. It depends on what you want to do. Some people will keep cichlids from some of the other rift lakes with them. And, that can work out. The water conditions are a bit different and so on, but some people do that anyway. Or other hardy cichlids with them. Even some of the South American cichlids can do okay on occasion, but some of them will get their fins chewed off, so be careful. Do research before you do that. I think it's better just to keep them with fish from their own lake.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
But, some people put clown loaches in with them because they can certainly hold their own with their little razor-sharp spikes that they have, and some people do things like that. So I would just say do your research first and do it at your own risk because they are aggressive fish.
Okay. As our last spotlight on the mbunas, let's talk about breeding.
Yeah, okay. Well, as I did say, it's good to keep a ratio of more females than males. And this is not a hard and fast rule all the time. I remember we had at least one species in there where we just had a male and a female and they were okay,
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say that that's the only way to do it.
It depends on the species.
Yeah, it really does. But if you keep male and female mbunas together, they will not only breed, they will hybridize.
So you can have five different species in there and who knows what you will get.
Right. Some species will hybridize, some won't, but there are a lot of species that will really readily hybridize. And so you have to be careful about that. that can be a problem. You don't
what
want
do you
to,
do about that?
For example, take those fish out of your tank and sell them to somebody and say, yeah, these are whatever, you know, what species one of the parents was, because they're not.
Right.
That can be very bad for the gene pool of that particular species, or even the very the local type, mm-hmm. because you have several species out there that have local types that are very popular because of particular color variation or whatever, and you don't even want to mix those with the same members of the same species, but a different local type, right? Different variety from a particular location in the lake. They're usually named after a location in the lake. And you don't want to mess that up. So if you are allowing your fish to hybridize, then don't let those fish go beyond your tank.
So what do you do with all the babies?
A lot of times what you can do really is, it's kind of, you know, how can I say it?
You put some of those catfish in that specialize in eating Bona
babies?
Yeah,
that's what I mean. Basically, it's a little rough, but you just let them do what they can. You can let them survive, whichever ones survive in the tank. A few may survive, and often do, a few of them, but not very many will. But you just make sure they stay in your tank, and that's where they will live out their lives.
So, is it going to be like rabbits?
No.
You
no.
always have Mbuna babies you don't know what to do with? Or
well,
just
there will
every
always
once
be,
in a while,
if you have a number of females that are reproducing, a few of the young will survive because the parents will eat some of them. And some of them won't get enough to eat and so on. But once in a while, you get some that grow up, and It depends a lot on the situation, the carrying capacity in the tank, how much food they're getting and stuff. Are you target feeding the babies on purpose, or are you just letting them pick up what they can? You know, things like that. And so basically you do have to just think, how many can I house? And you, the tank will sort of reach a natural equilibrium if you're not giving, you know, too much food and doing everything you need to do. They'll be okay. Just recognize you're responsible for those fish. And you're responsible for making sure that they are not put out into the world and, you know, diluting other species or messing up gene pools anywhere. But let's say that you have, and not all species will hybridize. So if you can find some species that are different enough in terms of their breeding habits and whatever, sometimes you can keep some together that won't hybridize. But let's say you have two or three species that are breeding and have several others that aren't, and you have them all together. So you find a female with a, you know, it looks like her throat's kind of swollen. And basically it means that they've spawned and the female has kept the eggs
in her
buccal cavity. Basically it's like her throat, sort of. And she will either avoid or reduce food intake for a couple of weeks while she's holding them in there, and she's just kind of incubating, protecting them. And then suddenly she'll spit them out and you'll see all these little fry everywhere. And for a little while, sometimes she'll take them back into her mouth and they're in danger. But soon they'll just be on their own, and they're big enough to take powdered food right away. They're big enough to start picking at algae or even grabbing bits off of bigger pieces of food that they see. Or you can give them microworms, you can give them baby pine shrimp, and they'll eat them readily. And, they're really easy in terms of food because they're...
Actually, it's pretty cool, though.
They're pretty big compared to, you know, a lot of other fish when they first exit their mother's mouth. And, they're really fun to watch grow up. They're careful. You'll see them down in the little interstices of the gravel or the between a rock and the gravel, places like that, yeah. So, yeah, that's about where we are, I guess.
Alrighty, so hopefully that gives you a decent overview of Mbunas.
Thanks, Tyson, for the question. It's probably stuff that you knew already because you keep Mbunas, but if you have any other things you'd like to add to that, or if any of you out there who keep Mbunas and would like to, you know, give us, chime in.
Shout out to your favorite species.
Yeah, something like that. Then let us know.
In the meantime,
may the fish be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.